Welcome to Skills for Crisis, a podcast for those who don't think it will get better, but keep trying. A podcast about discussing the tools, practices, and solidarities we might need to face crisis together. The podcast is part of the project Skills for Crisis, nurturing communities beyond tipping points. We went on a journey through topics around recentering mental health, solidarity in times of climate disasters, civil society work and mutual aid, and understanding the path of people on the move. The project is inspired by many activist groups, individual work, generations of thoughts and events. The main partners to organize this series of workshops, lectures and media outputs are three collectives: HOMOS, Educate Collective and Jazz Kulturi. We are educators, publicists and activists from Germany, Austria, Poland and Belarus. We want to thank, appreciate and honor generations of Black, Indigenous and people of color activists that have inspired us and many of the concepts and resources, like those contributing to the book Hospicing Modernity by Vanessa Machado de Oliveira, Adrienne Mary Brown and many others.
In this first podcast session, you will listen to Firuze Favadin, who was giving an input on politics of emotion from individual fields to collective cares.
First of all, before beginning, I want to also acknowledge something that I think for my side is very important to mention, and that is that this talk is not just based on my own individual kind of experience or work or observations, but I'm sharing today a collective reflection emerging from collaborators, conversation, and shared intellectual labor with activists, friends, and comrades. In particular, conversation and this work draws on work I have done with International Research Group on Authoritarianism and Counter-Strategies, known as IRGAC, now based in Potsdam University, but in collaboration with Rosa Luxemburg Foundations. And also, I really use the contribution and inspired by the contribution of my colleagues and comrades, name some of them, Gustavo Reples, Burias Nea, another Talebi. And more than anything else, also, I got inspiration by Beyond Molotovs, the visual handbook of anti-authoritarianism, which I contribute as one of the authors, but it's actually one of the project of IRGAC. And many of the examples I will share with you is coming from that book and narrations, kind of direct narrations of the account of anti-authoritarianism counter-strategies. So basically, I'm not speak as an expert above others, but as someone helping to narrate and connect the experience and the strategy of people resisting authoritarianism and building form of collective life under pressures. Equally important for me is also to mention that these examples and cases are not offering here or suggesting here to just imitate or uncritically adopt here, but more as a kind of, because there are living strategies rooted in different places, but I think it's important to take inspiration by them and when we kind of dealing with our own crisis that we in different localities we are facing. So first of all, why these conversations and not, and why now? So we are living in a time, as also Pablo mentions, that it feels entirely accurate to say that we are living through a global crisis. I think Pablo very elusively explain and elaborate about the conditions, the Gaza war as a, you know, kind of the mirror that we can, dark mirror that we can see. But to be honest, I can also argue that it's not, particularly from the global south, this crisis is not a new event. It's a continuation, I would say that, but a deepening and intensification of a structural violence and instability that has long shaped people's living in these conditions. Still, I still agree that the current global conjuncture is undeniably intense. We see overlapping economic, ecological, political, social, and now genocidal ruptures. Some trace this moment to the 2008 financial crisis, which marked the beginning of the neoliberal capitalism's demise. But instead of collapsing, basically what happened afterwards is the system mutated and becoming harsher and more authoritarian, more extractive all around the world. Social movements try to offer glimpses of the hope. I would say that in the past 10 years, different type of movement, specifically I would mention feminist movements, and also indeed statistics shows that, for instance, the global protests and riots almost double in the past 6 years. So we are, have more kind of protests in the world than any other time in the history of you know, social movements. But at the same time, the system has doubled down, not just with exploitations, but with emotional and psychological forms of control. So to understand how to resist better and successfully and live a livable life for most of us, we must understand how today's crisis operate, not just structurally, but emotionally. So what do we mean by crisis? I mean, of course, you already kind of, the discussion is about crisis, but I think it's important to start to talk about what is, or what is the understanding of crisis, at least in my mind. So it's a word we hear often, but it doesn't mean that the same things that for everyone. A crisis is not just an incident. It's a relational and political experience, I would say that. It's almost, in literal sense, in many of the language, crisis is at the same time both danger and opportunity in its literate meaning. Objectively, it marks a breakdown in how a society reproduces itself. Something can no longer go on as before. This is the stage of the, at least subjectively and psychic level, that something is not working anymore. And it is a moment of uncertainty when something new could emerge for a better or worse. You may have heard of Gramsci's talking about this moment as an interregnum, a time when the old world is dying, but the new cannot yet born. That's where we are, I would say that, in a space of disorder and at the same time, it's still possibility. And this is the side that I want to kind of emphasize more on that. But at the same time, as I said, that a crisis is not one thing, one single event. No one experienced the crisis, only fragments of it. Our experience of the crisis is shaped by where we are. For example, if you're here or in Gaza, who we are and how power operates around us. That's why it's crucial to understand that crisis is historical, conditional, intersectional, and mediated. Our framework that helps us grasp this concept, you may have heard, one of the also now famous coined by Adam Tooze, is polycrisis. Popularized in recent years, the idea of the polycrisis describe how different overlapping breakdowns from climate disaster to pandemics to rise of inequality and now genocidal wars interact in ways that are more overwhelming than any single cause. And you cannot reduce it in one single cause. Together, these interconnected crises challenge our capacity to cope, to think, and act against it. And importantly, they also make us feel vulnerable, anxious, and fearful. But we can also somehow see from the perspective of feminism that what is this crisis? They call it the crisis of care, or more broadly, a crisis of social reproduction. That is a breakdown in the system and mechanism that sustain and nurture life in very broad sense, not just biological life that is also under crisis, but also the social life, which includes education, healthcare, food, emotional support, communal infrastructures, basically those works that are mostly invisible, undervalued, and yet essential. Especially care work, as you may know, overwhelmingly done by women, migrants, racialized communities, has long been exploited and under-resourced. In a recent neoliberal kind of era and governance, this exploitation has, of course, intensified and commodified. Welfare systems have been dismantled. Families have been left to bear the burden. And when families cannot manage, the market steps in for those who can afford it, of course. But the result is actually a dual crisis, another kind of crisis that the feminists theorize about that. A shortage of care and a depletion of caregivers. People are burned out, entire communities are struggling to sustain themselves, and this is not just a personal burden, it is a political one. When just COVID-19 arrived, it didn't cause the crisis, it exposed and intensified it. Years of disinvestment in healthcare, housing, public infrastructure mean that many societies were simply unprepared. The pandemic just made this visible, what was always there. Life under capitalism is fragile. And yet even then, crisis management that they kind of offer the system, they not offer a solution for us. It simply deepened the same patterns of abandonment, extractions, and inequality. So what happened when in the moment of the crisis, system can no longer deliver stability, but also cannot imagine transformation? This is when authoritarianism become attractive. I mean, at least I'm talking about when become attractive in global north, because we already experienced it in global south differently because of the history of colonialism, extractivism, and many other things that Pablo also mentioned. We have seen authoritarian movements around the world from above and from below emerge or intensify as responses to uncertainty and collapse. Whether in a state form or in grassroots fascist movement, these forces do not promise justice. They promise order, stability, and the illusion of control. So this offer of stability, I think, is very important. They appeal not just through ideology, that is also important, but through emotions. And this is where we need to pause and talk about the emotional politics of authoritarianism and fascism, how it governs, mobilizes, and manipulates feelings in moments of uncertainty. So authoritarianism is not just built on institutions like police, although still coercive mechanisms are very important, but they are also built on affects and emotions. Fear, anxiety, resentment, and hope. These are not side effects. They are control and central tools. In this kind of architecture of fear, truth matters less than effect. It's not about facts, it's about feeling. One of the most powerful tactics of authoritarian project used emotional redirections, I would say that. One of the most crucial of these emotions are fear. Fear is not inherently reactionary, I would say that. It can be a source of caution, survival, and even care. So it's not in itself something reactionary. But under authoritarian politics, fear is weaponized. It's extracted from people's real vulnerability, their loneliness, their hunger, their sense of abandonment, and redirected toward fabricated enemies. Particularly in the moments of crisis, people feel more anxious, isolated, overwhelmed. And instead of addressing the root causes of this vulnerability, authoritarianism offers a shortcut. Blame someone else. The more insecure you are because of the condition you are in, the more tightly you cling to the story that gives you certainty, even if it's a lie. And it's in this case, this kind of lie about the others. This feeling of uncertainty turns actually the fear toward resentment, another important political emotions of our time. It creates scapegoats. Migrants, queer people, women, racialized communities, these are cast as the source of the instability people feel. In doing so, authoritarianism transforms private suffering, which itself is the result of years of neoliberal individualism and disintegration of infrastructure of care and communities into collective hatred. No, not yet hope. So, but it doesn't stop there, I would say that. Authoritarianism also offers something that many don't expect, a sense of belonging. It builds communities, actually. Communities organized around exclusion, but community nonetheless. So it's provide rituals, language, identity. It gives people who feel abandoned a place to stand, even if it's on someone else's back. We often assume that the far right has no future to offer. Actually, because now someone mentioned Naomi Klein and someone else, they're writing something about authoritarianism and fascist politics, and they kind of, I think somewhere they suggested that there is no future making of this kind of politics. I'm kind of not agree with that. Actually, they are very into future making. That is not just nostalgic backward looking, but this is misleading to see it like that. Authoritarian movements do offer visions of the future, just not ones based on freedom and equality. And of course, it is the place that the progressive forces lose their legitimacy because they have less to offer in terms of visions for the future. So the far rights and the fascist movements promise survival. They promise restoration. They promise a purified world where everything makes sense again, make great again, but also make sense again. They create utopias, or maybe this utopias for us, gated utopias where only some allowed to thrive, of course. So it's a very exclusionary, but still there is a vision. And here is the danger. These projects aren't just fantasies. They are being built, and we know that they are building this with technology. Through separatist enclaves, patriarchal networks, paramilitary formations, there are, one author called it, I forgot unfortunately the name, now utopias, lived experimental alternatives that enact a non-democratic, non-pluralist vision of the life. They may seem dystopian to us, but to their followers, they feel like salvation. That's why any serious counter strategy must engage with this. Authoritarianism is organizing not just institutions, but emotion, and it's offering people a future, even if it is built on violence and exclusion. So any counter strategy need to also have this vision of the future and promise something for the better. And also take it seriously, emotions. And here is that is coming the counter strategy that for me is I call it politics of care. It is a specific or a specific understanding of solidarity, as Pablo also mentioned, as one of the strategy, but it is not the only strategy. It is another issue that I want to kind of highlight. This is one of the counter strategy in our time. It doesn't mean that we should put all resources just on these issues, but I think it's one of them that shows that it could be crucial and strategically help us to build a better future. So what can be done? Here is the grassroots autonomous movement, particularly from the global south, have something powerful to offer. A counter strategy rooted in the struggles for life against resentment, fear, and fascist and exclusionary future making. What I borrow from feminist literature and practices, particularly from Black feminism, politics of care. Care is not, in this understanding, is not soft or passive. It's not opposite of resistance. Rather, it is a poor form of resistance, a way of collectively creating life that rejects abandonment and exclusion. Care is not, in this understanding, one-sided and patronizing act, because as you know, many of the solidarity movement are patronizing and one ways, and it is against this logic. More importantly, the logic is based on different practices of commoning, defending, and regenerating, reclaiming common resources. But more importantly, so it's of course it's about infrastructure and resources, but more importantly, social relations and communities, which we need to collectively survive and thrive. So it's also commoning in the sense of community building or community, sustaining the community that we already have or reclaiming them. So you may heard or yourself experience in the aftermath of disasters like earthquake, during curfews, in the margin of the cities, marginalized communities, holding each other, feeding each other, mourning with each other. These are not a romantic stories, I would say that. They are, and they could be, form of daily survival. And also, more importantly, I see them as strategic and political. In Global South, for instance, community kitchens often run by women didn't just feed people during economic collapse since 2000. I mean, in some country 2000, but particularly after 2008, they become spaces of political education, solidarity, and survival. Or during the pandemic crisis, informal neighborhood initiative provided food, health support, and mutual aid to their own peoples. These networks, built in the absence of state and public care, become crucial for sustaining and protecting life during the crisis, but they are not charity. And I think it's very important. They are deeply political, strategic, and the aim at the transformative change is what make them distinguish from reformist NGOs or mainstream civil activism. So the visions that they offer and the transformations that they want to kind of go toward, that is very important to distinguish it with the, you know, everyday charity-based works. But let me give you some very concrete example. That, I extract some of them from the book Beyond Molotovs and some of them based on my own research, co-research with others. So the first one is the story of Verdurazzo, if I pronounce correctly, Verdurazzo. And they call the story of Verdurazzo feeding as resistance in Argentina. So it's a story of a group of people in Argentina, small farmers, peasants, and many of them migrants who grow most of the vegetables that feed the countries. I mean, 60% of the vegetables basically done and farmed by them. But they didn't even, or still, they many of them, they don't own the land they work on. They live in a wooden shacks and farm in burning heat and freezing cold and pay rent just to grow food they often can't afford to eat themselves. So this is the conditions that they were in it. After a huge economic crisis of 2001 that you may heard about that, when over half the country fell into poverty, these farmers came together and formed a union. I cannot pronounce correctly the Spanish one, but the translation is the Land Workers Union or UTT. But they didn't just ask for better condition, which they did also. So they demand for the better conditions, but they redefined what resistance could look like. The UTT start organizing to eliminate harmful pesticides by developing agroecological farming practices through years of collective research and training. They also built a fair and autonomous commerce system to fight food speculation and ensure access to healthy produce. So these farmers and some activists get together to make this possible from 2001 onwards. So, but instead of slogans and protests, they also, as a flag, they use vegetables as a kind of sign of their politics. They began organizing what they call verdurazos. Beside everyday act of providing infrastructure of their lives, they organized massive action in the heart of big cities. They gave away, and how? They gave away fresh, healthy produce for free. Crates of tomatoes, eggplants, potatoes placed on sidewalks near train station, government offices, and even in the presidential palace. So basically, they kind of said that we are the ones that provide the food, and we want to give it free to others. So it's a kind of act of resistance or kind of protest against the system that make it hard for them to farm and to sell directly their vegetables. It was not the act of charity. They were act of defiance in a country where neoliberal government let people go hungry while favoring big agribusiness over the farmers. Farmers said, we feed the country and we will feed the people directly. This was a kind of care as a rebellion. So it's also an act of care, but it's differently. So, and of course, they didn't like it. At one Verdurazzo, for example, as you can see in these pictures, the police attack not only on the people, but also the vegetables. They threw tear gas as crates of food. They made the produce inedible. They arrested and intimidated those handing it out. Still, the movement grew. They launched feriazos, markets with fair prices, bypassing middlemen in general. They train, as I said, that the agriculture kind of knowledge to avoid using toxic pesticides. They created horizontal networks for decision making. They did not wait for a future utopia. They built solidarity through the most basic and vital things, that is the food. And they are still continue their works, impressive works. Another example, again, from the Argentina is the community or soup kitchens. that actually they are connected with the network of Ferriazos, and many of these kitchens collaborate with Verdorazos as well. But it's, I mean, their works is different. At first glance, these community kitchens are places where people come to get a warm meal during hard times, particularly in the time of crisis in the past 5 years in the country. But they are much more than that. These kitchens, mostly run by feminist and grassroots groups and collectives, are spaces of survival and of political imaginations for many. So basically, they have not only food, give a food to thousands of the people, but also offered something deeper, a place for talk, to learn, to organize a community, a big community. They have provided legal help for women facing domestic violence. They have supported people trying to re-enter the job market, and they have given political education, helping communities understand the forces that make life so hard and how to change them. So it's become really, really politicized during the process. Also, it started from for the surviving strategy. In doing so, these kitchens have challenged the government neglect and economic policies that leave people behind. They have become the symbol of care, resistance, and self-organizations. And they have grown powerful enough that the current government under fascist Javier Milei has made a point of cutting their funding. One of the first things that the president do is that to kind of cut the funding for them. But of course, not because they don't work, but because they work very well. They show people that another way of living and supporting each other is possible. So that's why these kitchens are not about food, although itself is very important. They are also about hope with roots. Hope served in one plate, one conversation, one act of care at a time. This is what resisting authoritarianism, I would say, that overcoming the consequences of living polycrisis can look like, not only through confrontation, that is also important sometimes, but through building new form of life together, feeding each other, caring for each other, organizing fair distribution, not just of food, but of hope. I want to have to give you two more examples from different territories, but I don't know how it's my time frame. So if need to kind of cut it short, I prefer to just talk about one of them.
Yes, I would say you have another 5 minutes, and then we have like 5 to 7 minutes for questions.
So maybe I kind of skip one of them that is also from Latin America, but I will talk maybe later about that. So I'm talking about another one that is somehow I feel more connected. It's from my homeland, from Iran. So it's about the feminist revolution in Momentum of 2022 that you may heard about that. And I'm just briefly explain the context. A young Kurdish woman named Jina Mahsa Amini was arrested and beaten to death while in custody by so-called morality police, but not even for what she said or did as a protest, but because what she wore. Her hijab wasn't considered proper, and she dies of her injuries some days after getting beaten. Her murder sparks a nationwide uprising, although it was not the first incident the same. Within the days, over 160 cities and many villages across Iran erupt to the protests. It was not, of course, the first time Iranians took a street to show their discontent. After all, they had experienced and witnessed two revolutions in the 20th century, and many more protests and uprising, particularly under the Islamic Republic rule in recent years. But this time, it was a bit different in terms of forms and also demands that they had. The recent protests are not led by politicians or political groups or celebrities. There is no central committee or charismatic figure. Instead, they rise from below, from women and gender dissidents, from the margins, from communities like Kurdish and Baluchi minorities, who for long ignored or oppressed. The slogan, Jinjian Azadi, women, life, freedom, spreads like a wildfire. And with it, something deeper is revealed. So this is the context. For years, like many other authoritarian contexts, politics in Iran, even oppositional politics, has been dominated by fear, different kind of fear. Fear of war, fear of civil collapse, fear of speaking out, fear that things could always got worse, fear of mass execution and incarceration, that of course they have the basis for that because of their past experience. That fear, this general fear, constantly reproduced by the regime, so it's also channelized by the regime, has kept many people to silent. But in this specific moment, fear lost its grip. People stood up, not just with anger and resentment, but this time, surprisingly, with care, with and toward each others. And it is very impressive because regime was very successful before that to kind of divide also oppositions in terms of different discontents in societies. For example, feminist movement, it's not connected at the time with the, you know, worker activists, or they were not in connections with the, those fighting for the ethnic and religious minorities. But that moment was different in a sense that is kind of unite their anger and channelize their anger toward something else. And that is, to me, is what makes the what's happening in 2022 in Iran a feminist revolution. Not because the women and gender dissident were at the forefront, that is already they were and it's important, but because the entire logic and the uprising was grounded in a politics of care. But this radical care has a background and has a history. So it's not just come out in the streets. It's kind of valorized in the street, but it was there. It was already there, quietly in the neighborhoods and networks long before Jinnah's name became a kind of call to rise. It lived in the COVID mutual aid groups where neighbors brought food and medicine to each other when the state failed to help. It lived in teachers and cultural workers associations demanding justice in a school and fighting for free, equitable education for everyone and in every language people speak in Iran long before. And because it's very important because, you know, in Iran, ethnic and religious minorities rights systematically ignored and suppressed, and they cannot also, of course, have education in their mother tongues. And almost 50% of the Iranians' mother tongues are not Farsi. So you can imagine that how it could be an important issue. But it's not, of course, just the cultural issues. It's really deeply materialist issues. It also lived in environmental groups, protecting water, land, and forests in places, particularly in those marginalized regions of Iran, underdeveloped regions, Khuzestan, Kurdistan, and Baluchistan, often facing more violence than those living in the big cities. It also lived in solidarity funds that helped families of political prisoners to survive during the past 20 years, and in women-led community networks born in recent economic crisis and environmental disaster that turn everyday survival into the shared resistance. So these are not the, just some, you know, small things. They are not the headlines. They are the infrastructure of care built by feminized and marginalized bodies that help people when fear tried to isolate them. When the protests erupted across the country at the time, these networks didn't just support this. They become its infrastructure, its skeleton, its circulatory system, its soul. Basically, they were the ones that coordinate this huge, massive protest in 160 cities. So that's the things that everyone talk about. Okay, there is no leader in this movement. So it's how could it possible that this movement sustained for more than 8 months? But this is this infrastructure that is make it possible and politicized. I just give one example of this initiative that there are thousands, but the ones that I think important to mention is the clear example is the Coordinating Council of Cultural Workers, a grassroots network of educators who connected over 200 cities across the country, actually overlap with those cities that got into the protests. Not only support, they guilt this council, but they also connected their agendas to other movements. For instance, they defended the right to education in mother tongues, as I said, and put them in alliance with ethnic and national minorities in Iran. Regarding gender violence, they are among those that give a statement and kind of public call to protest against this systematic femicide that happened in Iran. So it's a kind of, each itself is very heroic and considering the level of repression in Iran, and they call for the demonstration for the, I mean, it's one of the real official associations that call for demonstration against the state femicide of Jina Amini. So it's, they were really kind of powerful in this sense. And actually in the late 2022, they helped one of the main initiators of writing the first demand for a post-Islamic Republic future, at the time that everyone hopeful that it's going to be post-Islamic Republic. So they were the ones that actually written visions for future, very progressive one, grounded in dignity, equality, and care. And that's why it's not surprising that many of them now are in prisons, and the organizer. But their network is still working. And as I said, it's just one example of the many. So I 2 minutes, I will finish.
Yes,
sorry.
Great. Thank you.
So these examples, mainly feminist counter-strategy that I gave there, just respond to authoritarianism. They prefigure something else. They offer what the state and other institutions do not: collective security, emotional solidarity, and political imagination. Care is not only about providing services, it's about redefining what is politics. When we center care, we change the term what counts as political work. We recognize that cooking a meal, organizing a ride, checking in on someone, these are not distraction from a struggle. There are struggles given that they have this transformative vision. So not any act of care, but those that have this vision. In this sense, politics of care challenge both the violence of the state and the limits of traditional or mainstream activism. They invite us to imagine different forms of being together, not just in resistance, but in everyday. And this is not easy. As we know, this type of collective political care work is exhausting. It's thankless most of the time. It can replicate the same inequalities that we are trying to dismantle. That's why it must be done consciously, with attention to power, exhaustion, and sustainability. They are not perfect. They are messy. As always, they said that the feminist work are a messy work and full of conflicts and uncertainties. Still, I would say that care remains one of the most radical tools we have. It allows us to resist the emotional and utopian grammar of authoritarianism, to replace fear with trust and resentment and with solidarity, and false hope with real possibility. Thank you.